I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the serial entrepreneur Gary Kremen. Gary is the founder of Match.com, an online dating service that he started in 1993. Gary is also the founder of Clean Power Finance, an online marketplace for the solar energy sector, and Sociogramics, a financial services company that uses social media and behavioral economics to provide capital to consumers who don't otherwise have access to credit. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here.
I'd like to start with your upbringing. You grew up in Chicago. What did your parents do?
Both of my parents were teachers in the Chicago public school system. My dad was a driver's ed instructor. My mom taught accounting 37 years for my father.
What were you like as a kid?
Probably bratty. I was kind of a habitual problem child. While I was a good student, I ended up at the police a couple times. I remember one of my claims to fame is I broke all these windows and the police picked me up and made me go to the property owners and apologize. And me and a friend sat in the cell. And then another time we climbed the roof of our elementary school and broke a window and they took money from the Coke machine. I mean, I got kicked out of school for changing a program. And this was in the 70s and printing out some profanity. And that was that kind of intellectual problem child.
Did you have girlfriends growing up?
I had one girlfriend, but I wasn't very good at it, and maybe Match.com was my way of trying to the idea of online dating was my way of kind of maybe more getting more deal flow, as we'd call it today.
What were some odd jobs that you had as a kid?
I spent years actually working after school in a warehouse loading and unloading trucks. Mm. In fact, I worked for this guy who was a pretty good entrepreneur who did things like when Burger King had a misprint on glasses they were handing out. Like there was a misspelling. He would buy them all at 3 cents on a dollar and sell them in loco bodegas, you know. And I would be loading and unloading trucks for him for years and years and years. And when Pan Am went out of business, he bought all the little tchotchkes, like the little pins they gave kids and all the safety vests that were under the seat and found buyers for it. Mm-hmm. So that was like probably my first example of someone who could figure out how to make a profit in the situation.
You went to Northwestern. You graduated in 1985 and then made your way to Stanford Business School. Why do you think Stanford Business School accepted you?
Well, I talked about being an entrepreneur, and I had kind of an unconventional background because out of undergraduate, I decided I wanted to work in a nonprofit looking for fraud, mismanagement, and waste in the Department of Defense. And I think that was different from the normal investment bankers and consultants they had.
But you did work at Goldman Sachs one summer.
I did.
During Stanford Business School, and you rubbed one of the managing directors the wrong way, such that they offered to pay you to leave. What happened there?
They did. They offered to buy my summer out after about week four to leave them alone. I don't know if I rubbed one person wrong. I think I rubbed everyone wrong.
So did you kind of get a rise from challenging authority? Was this something that you liked to perpetuate, or this is just, you know, Gary Kremen?
Just the way I am, that sometimes me being there 4 weeks, I thought I knew as much as, you know, managing partners that have been there 20 years.
After graduating from Stanford Business School in 1989, you started two companies because you knew you were better off with your own gig. The first was a software company and then a computer securities company called Los Altos Technologies. And it was at Los Altos where the idea for an online dating company hatched. Can you explain how the idea for Match.com came to you?
So I had an epiphany one day. I noticed that we started getting purchase orders for our products. And I noticed that one day we got a purchase order from a woman. Mm-hmm. And that never happened in my history before, that actually getting email on the internet from some woman. And we're sitting around the office thinking, I wonder if, you know, what she's like and if there's any way we could learn more about her. And I realized that, oh, more women were going to get on the internet, because back then there were hardly any on the internet. And I realized, I wonder if I could create a database of all the women who are coming online and sell access to it and then marry number one.
Hmm.
Sort. Marry number one.
And marry number one.
That's right.
This was the first woman, the woman who placed this order. Did you think you might marry her? Or
she could have been, and I was curious. So I wonder if I could convince her I wonder if I could get her zip code. I had it. Actually, I had her zip code. I wonder if I could find the closest Kinko's, convince her to go scan her picture in, and then do a write-up on her. So that was kind of some of my first ideas.
Because this certainly was top of mind was finding a mate.
Top of mind was finding a mate. And then just not me. I noticed there was a market in it on both sides. So at about the same time, I did my first good setup. I set up a friend with another friend, and they got married. I was like, wow, I wonder if they should have paid me for that whole process.
You at the time were also active in telephone dating services. You would pay $2.99 a minute for these 1-900 numbers. How did they work?
So there were newspapers out there, a lot of the alternative newspapers. All they were a little bit of content around these listings for 900 numbers, and you would read a little short description. You would call, paying $2.99 a minute to hear a description, a more detailed description, and then leave a message. And I realized a lot of people who own not only these newspapers, but other newspapers and classified, so were more richer than me. In fact, I didn't have too much money, but they did, and I wanted some of their money.
In 1993, you started a company called Electric Classifieds Incorporated with Match.com as your first service, and the idea was to take offline classifieds and put them online.
That's right. I realized that newspapers would be slow. I went to go talk to a couple of them, and I said, if I have all these domain names, I could create brands around each category and put these newspapers out of business.
So your first subset of this electronic classifieds was Match.com, this online dating idea, and you bought the domain name for $2,500, which at the time was a pretty hefty number. Only 5% of Americans had internet access. How did you go about buying the domain name? From whom?
So, first I used my credit card cash advance, as many entrepreneurs do. And I found the guy who was registered to, some person in Las Vegas who tried to do something in email and dating, and it never happened. And I think I came out of the blue like some sucker who was willing to write a check for something that had no value. I had this vision that I could do this whole thing through email, and you could say send picture of person number 27 and the picture would show up. And actually, that's what happened. That's how the early days were before the web.
Right, because this was an email dating service before the World Wide Web became more popular.
In fact, most people didn't even know the web was going to be. There were some alternate ideas, things called links and Archie, and no one knew where it was going to evolve. So we built a system that could talk to many different protocols, including faxes. People could fax in, and we'd use optical character recognition and realize what they were asking for. But eventually, the email service took off. We're growing at 3-4% a day.
How did the email service take off? Who were some of those early adopters?
Well, I realized something from talking to friends of mine, women friends, that I was able to kind of understand what some of their needs were in this area that was kind of a tough area, which is putting yourself out online where everyone could see what you were looking for, which was kind of a taboo area. I realized that privacy, security, and anonymity were very important. So I kind of came up with the idea of the anonymous handle that would have email and really focusing on respect in the process and the belief that one woman would bring 100 men, at least back then.
So give an example. So, Janet Smith wants to find a boyfriend, so she emails you, Gary, her picture.
Or maybe she just emails her biographical info, and we would do matching in our database to find out who would be looking for someone like Janet Smith around her, and we would send her the list in email.
So you would look at a database, just a list of guys who had signed up?
No, it was done by an algorithm that we wrote and everything like that. But yeah, basically that was the idea. It's called matching. We matched.
Were you a participant in this?
No, actually, by that time, I actually had a girlfriend, which was hard to believe, but I did have one. So I was more of a looking at the process, but I wasn't touching the goods, so to speak.
I see.
Now, she did touch the goods and married someone from the service.
Now, at the time, you had a girlfriend, so you weren't using Match.com. Have you ever used Match.com?
I've never used it. Not that I'm against the idea or anything like that. It was just the circumstances.
You are married now.
I am.
And you have two children, two boys. How did you meet your wife?
I met my wife through a mutual friend who didn't know that we were each interested. So what I did when I realized I really need to get married is I made an offer. And if you set me up with the woman I marry, you get a trip to Hawaii for two.
Who did you make the offer to?
Everyone I knew.
What is her name and what does she do?
Her name's Petia, and she's a physician who specializes in integrative and holistic healthcare. I knew she was the one. And I think, you know, maybe by date four, she knew I was the one. You know, after we worked some those issues out, like the dog thing and stuff like that.
I remember when I first was learning about Match.com that there was a stigma attached to, oh, joining Match.com, and people were kind of embarrassed by it. That seems to have dissipated over the years now. How many marriages and how many successful matches have there been?
So probably successful matches in the millions, definitely the same number of marriages, but the stigma was the biggest obstacle to success, and worked pretty hard to make it a safe, secure, and friendly place and kind of change behaviors and beliefs that this is a positive, not a negative. It's definitely a feature, not a bug.
So what were some examples of things that you did to try to mitigate that stigma?
Absolute privacy, booting creepy people off quickly, throttling the amount of emails people could send to others, doing good matches, telling people if there was no match, there was just no match. Truthfulness, transparency.
The service, the email service, as well as the website eventually, started really growing 3-4% a day, really through word of mouth. What was one of those catalysts or turning points that really helped to escalate the popularity and growth of the service?
You know, one that I would say is I like to say we invented affiliate marketing. As far as I know, before we did it, no one came up with the idea of actively going out and marketing links to your website as opposed to marketing your web name and URL. And I was a big believer that let's go get the Women's Wire of the world to have a dating section and we'll be the back end for it. So I think the idea of affiliate marketing, something we all take for granted, was one of the ways we did very well. And two is we kept our service running. I know it's the craziest thing, but it's kind of an entrepreneurial lesson that you could have something great, but if it's not working all the time, it's kind of a suboptimum consumer experience.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is a serial entrepreneur, Gary Kremen. Gary is the founder of Match.com, an online dating service that he started in 1993. We'll hear more from Gary coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is a serial entrepreneur, Gary Kremen. Gary is the founder of Match.com, an online dating service that he started in 1993. In addition to Match.com, you owned a number of generic domain names, jobs.com, housing.com, autos.com, and then sex.com, which was later the subject of a lawsuit. Whom did you acquire these domain names from in the early 1990s?
There was one organization giving them away, and I just, no one thought of going to ask. So I had an epiphany that generic words that are in the classified advertising would be very valuable one day. So there happened to be a little government contractor called Network Solutions in Herndon, Virginia, that somehow wrangled the exclusive right to give out these domain names, and they weren't getting paid per domain name because they were free. They were getting paid by, they would add up their costs and add 20% and charge the National Science Foundation for it. They were basically an office of four or five people who coordinated the handing out of IP addresses and domain names and associated internet artifacts. And they hit on, and I think about 95, that they should be charging $75 from that. That later was bought by VeriSign and became a huge public company just based on the revenue from that.
Did you pick up the phone and call them and say, hey, I want to buy jobs.com?
So I sent in to an email address, and I said I wanted jobs.com, and I filled out a form. And I did that for all the domain names except the one that I did last, which was sex.com. And I realized okay, I don't want this to get lost in email or someone on the other side to see what a good idea is. So I sent in a certified letter, and that was really good because there was a record of a certified letter.
So going back to Match.com, you raised about $4 million from angel investors and venture capital funds, and they invested in Electric Classifieds, which owned Match.com. And very early on, you and they did not see eye to eye. What are some examples of divergent points of view?
There was a couple different divergent points of view. Divergent point of view number one was, I believe that working with newspapers was doomed to fail. They were slow. They didn't get it in today's vernacular. Most of my board wanted to go work with newspapers, and that's kind of how they thought, well, let's go work with big companies. That's good. And I felt smaller entrepreneurial companies would grab the market, and I was actually right on that. Number two is, once when Match took off, I wanted to focus on that. I wanted to run with the winner. And they were like, well, let's go be the outsource partner for newspapers. And I just felt too slow. We'd never get there.
You owned a number of domain names at the time, jobs.com, housing.com, autos.com, sex.com. And they were fine with putting all these domain names under the auspices of Electric's Classifieds, except for sex.com. Why did they not want sex.com in there?
Well, it was one in a many series of embarrassments that traditional stodgy venture capitalists who are backed by pension funds feel. The word sex were embarrassed. When I introduced gay dating, they almost had heart attacks right there and then, and they kind of told me not to do it, and I did it anyhow. When I said not everyone's for marriage, some people are looking for shorter-term relationships, I think I almost got fired that day.
Sex.com ended up being not just a scandalous affair, which we'll get to, but also your most lucrative domain name that you owned.
That's true. That's true. So that was another strategic mistake they made. I mean, I made a lot of my own mistakes, please. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm Mr. Mistake.
So what are some other mistakes that you made in the early days of Match.com?
So didn't understand the importance of who's on your board. Thinking all money is green was a big mistake. And I think I was pretty abrasive as a leader. I mean, I made a lot of leadership mistakes. I think I got the strategy right, for sure, but the tactics I wasn't as good at.
I heard a story that you fired a personal assistant or an administrative assistant because she wouldn't work 7 days a week. Is that true?
That's true, because everyone else was working 7 days a week, and it felt that there's always something to do, even if it's emptying the wastebasket, and I felt that that wasn't team spirit if you're going to take Sundays off. Because I was working Sundays, and I expected everyone else to work Sundays.
You were the CEO of Match.com for the first 2 years before you were ousted by the board.
That's right.
How did you feel when they voted you out?
You know, it hurt my feelings. I think that was one area where they were right. I was not mature enough to see that back then.
But at the time, you were just despondent and thought, these guys don't know what they're talking about.
Well, I have another good story. So when I raised money from the investors I did raise the money from, I had an offer from another set of investors, a more prestigious set of investors, like the best venture funds, Kleiner Perkins, IVP. And their condition on the investment was that I bring in a CEO. They had two conditions. One is bring in a CEO, and they would be let me part of the process. And two, they wanted to merge me with this other company, and I would have half the equity, and these other six people would have the other half of the equity. But no, they taught me in school, you want to be the leader, you want to be the CEO. So I said no. So I took the people who said you could be the CEO. Now that company went on, those six guys went on to change their name from Architects to Excite, and I would have had half of Excite and part vested too. One of those, you know, couple $100 million mistakes that are common in my career.
And Excite went on to
be Excite at home and worth billions at the peak.
You left the company after 2 years, and the company was ultimately sold in 1997 for $7 million to Sendint, which is a consumer service company. And a year and a half later, the company was sold for $50 million to City Search Ticketmaster, which is owned by IAC, Barry Diller's Interactive Corporation. You made $50,000 from that sale.
I did.
How did that happen?
Well, it was part of the dispute over what direction the company wanted to do. But actually, the story worked out okay. I'll tell you the whole story. So what happened is I said, no, let's focus on this winter match. Let's have nothing to do with newspapers. We had big fights over it, and the board wanted to do the strategy of enabling newspapers to get online. And after they sold it, after my fervent objective, the company raised lots of money and it went out of business in 2001.
What company?
Match.com's parent, Electric Classifieds. They raised a lot more money trying to sell the newspapers, and it went out of business.
Got it.
So that was bad. But the good thing is I invented a bunch of things, and we got some patents. Like, I invented dynamic web pages, something every website uses today. So in 2004, a couple years later, I went and bought the debt in the last round, and I had a foreclosure sale to get that patent. And some other bidders came in, and I owned enough debt that on my $30,000 investment, I made a couple million dollars. So okay. That's better than a sharp stick in the eye.
So it was more than $50,000 in a very indirect manner.
Yeah, it was very indirect. But the real thing, $50K.
You had given up equity along the way,
ultimately? Oh, yeah. It's not that anyone else made any money. In fact, I think I was the only one who got any liquidity, even $50K. They all lost everything.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Gary Kremen, the founder of Match.com, the world's largest online dating service. After the sale of Match.com, how were you doing?
Well, I was definitely bumming about the situation, but it was in such a good time in 1997 where a lot was going on, and I did have some unique knowledge. So I started working with a guy or two who had some ideas around collaborative filtering, something we see recommendation engines back then, and got that merged with a company called Firefly, and we eventually sold it to Microsoft.
For how much?
That was, I think, total $40 million. Mm-hmm. So that didn't suck.
Contemporaneous with these successful investments, you had a tumultuous period with a lawsuit over the ownership of sex.com. You had owned the domain name and contended that somebody had fraudulently taken it from you. Can you describe that briefly?
Sure. So I registered the name in 1994, first person who ever registered it. And I wasn't really focusing on it. I had all these other entrepreneurial things I was working on. And one day someone said, hey, didn't you own that name, sex.com? And I'm saying, yeah. They go, no, this guy, Stephen Michael Cohen, has it's registered under his name. And I'm like, what? And I look it up, and it was true. It did. So I found out Mr. Cohn, who is a 5-time convicted felon, bankruptcy fraud, obstruction of justice, impersonating a judge, impersonating a lawyer, he stole the name from me. And he started, put up a website, and he was soon making about $1 million a month off the name.
Now, at the time, ownership of URLs or of domain names wasn't as secure as it is now, because it was really still the early days. So when you say he stole the name from you, how did that happen?
So initially, this is going to sound dumb, but I didn't realize how valuable the name was. I didn't know anything about the sex industry. I didn't realize it was such a big deal. So I had a little kind of investment firm. And there was a lawyer just fresh out of law school named Sherry Falco, and I gave her $2,500 to go investigate what happened. And that's how the whole thing started. And she found out about this. And then she got a call from the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office saying, well, the reason Mr. Cohn now has the name, even whether he took it or not, is he had a trademark on the name. So we let it drop. We found out later that he was impersonating the USPTO, one of many things that he's impersonated in the case. So after
he had called her directly?
Oh, yeah, and said he was from the Patent and Trademark Office. And she believed it, and I believed it, too. And it hit us later that you can't have trademarks on generic words. So eventually we filed this lawsuit.
And so you found yourself associated with the porn industry pretty publicly. What was your view of that?
Well, what can you do? I needed the money while at the time I was having legal bills of $100,000 or $200,000 a month. I needed financial support for what I was doing. I didn't have liquidity from my investments yet.
And how much of your mind space or of your headspace was this lawsuit taking up while you were trying to focus on your investing?
Well, eventually it took up 110% of my time. I learned the law. I read every brief, every pleading, which there was over 1,700 It's the longest case, I believe, in the Northern District.
When you finally got sex.com back, what did you do with the site until you sold it?
So I didn't want to run an adult site, and I came up with the idea of turning it into a search engine because there was so much traffic, and then selling those search results to other search engines. And eventually I sold it.
Isn't that effectively running an adult site or perpetuating the porn industry?
Okay, I didn't kill the porn industry. I had to eat. I had to pay my $5.6 million of legal bills I had.
And your judgment was $65 million in damages, but you didn't get the $65 million, so...
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, I've still been collecting. So all I got out of it was a lot of heartache. I did get a house eventually. I did take the bad guy's house, and I lived in it for a couple of years.
Really? How did it make you feel to be, like, in the bedroom of the bad guy? Why would you do that? Of all houses you could choose.
It was kind of a nice house. It was in Rancho Santa Fe, which is this nice area of, yes, that's true, a nice area of San Diego. And I don't know, there was something to it because he tormented me so much. Yeah, there was a little redemption. I mean, some of it was functional. Some might be dysfunctional. I sold it a couple of years ago.
Your income stream has been kind of erratic, it seems. You haven't had a steady flow of income.
I have not, and banks are always saying something to me about that.
Was there a time after you started Match.com where you were worried about, you know, your financial state?
No, because I was always living pretty low. So I was living in the Western Addition section of San Francisco in a $300 share, and I was eating burritos for years and years and years. So I kept my burn rate super, super low. And the landlord didn't like the fact that I wasn't making any money. And I don't know. So I'm actually sometimes a nice person. So I met this like semi-homeless guy, and I let him sleep on my couch for a couple days. And he took some pictures of the guy leaving, and he tried to evict me.
You have since moved away from the dating and the adult industry to a cleaner energy, the cleaner energy sector. How have you made that shift? Was it a mindful shift or an accidental one?
Well, I've always been interested in not always the energy part, but sustainable living and systems that would work forever and that were light touch on the environment, kind of the leaving no trace. I've always had an interest in that area. So just after I sold sex.com, I invested in a friend's company, and she had women-friendly solar panels was her idea. So I gave her money to kind of produce these, well, what I thought they were going to be mustard or taupe-colored solar panels, racking systems, because her belief was that women were some of the big decision makers in the purchase of solar, and they're ugly. And if they made them, and it made sense to me. So what happened was not as many people were buying the mustard or taupe-colored panels as she thought. And I asked her why. And I go, aren't you selling to all these rich people? She said they don't have the money up front for it. Hmm. And I had this epiphany of the idea of why not create a financing company to finance solar panels. And if the financing product would be correctly designed, the consumers would pay less than the cost of energy from their utility bill, and they'd want to sign up for that. And that actually worked out. I wrote some software that helped the installer do their job, and then they all ran this software, and then we introduced the financing product eventually. I mean, there was a lot of twists and turns.
Now, Kleiner Perkins is one of the investors in this company. Who are the other venture folks?
Claremont Creek Ventures, Google, Clean Pacific Ventures, and a lot of individual angels, including myself.
Were you at all worried that your reputation would be tainted in this new chapter of yours as you were raising capital, for instance?
I was a little bit. The good news is investors want to make money, and, you know, any challenges in reputation stop when you have a good idea. They want to make money. They don't care about the past as much, I found. Hmm. As an investor, I'm kind of like that, too.
This time around, you brought in a CEO. You knew you didn't want to be the CEO. Is that just a matter of growing up? I mean, you were 30. You were in your late 20s, early 30s when you were launching Match.com and trying to run it. Is there anything else that is attributable to this change?
Well, I've heard, Jessica, if someone hits you on the head enough times, you remember, like, oh, I don't want to be hit on the head. So I remembered, I'm not that good of a manager of people. Why don't I find someone who is a good manager of people?
Now, your other company, Sociogramics, which you launched in 2010, is a financial service company that facilitates lending to the underbanked. And you're using social media tools to help determine credit worthiness. What's an example of a social media tool that you might use to influence responsible borrowing?
Let me give you a really clear example. Today, when someone applies for a loan, if they can't find them at the credit bureau, they're usually just denied unilaterally. But there's a lot of people who aren't in the credit bureau or don't have an extensive credit file. We believe that using social media, finding their profiles out there and other traces of them and other ways of verifying they're real people with real jobs, that's good enough reasons to lend to them.
Your idea for Sociogramics came from a personal place. What is that story briefly?
So I had a great relationship with a bank in Marin, California. And I knew the officers there. They knew my story. They knew my situation. And they could tailor products and services to me. The bank got taken over by a large bank, Union Bank. And it was like night and day difference. Instead of talking to the CEO when I had a need or my representative, it was a call center. And the relationship soured quickly. And it got me thinking why the personal touch is not only important from the consumers, it's important from the bank side. So I got thinking, is there a way we could use software to bring back community lending? One of our ideas is start bringing back essays and having people write about what they're going to do with the money and what's their been history of repayment. And I think there's a lot of efficacy to that.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
I'm honored to be here, Jessica.
My guest has been Gary Kremen.
Coming up, we'll meet Michael Brown, co-founder of CityYear. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Michael Brown, co-founder of CityYear, an organization focused on addressing the national dropout crisis, where 1 million American students drop out of high school every year. CityYear's almost 3,000 core members serve as tutors, mentors, and role models in America's most challenging public schools. Prior to starting CityYear in 1988, Michael clerked for then-judge, now-justice Stephen Breyer. Welcome.
Thanks, Jessica. It's great to be here.
Could you tell me the experience of a CityYear core member?
So a CityYear core member is on average around 22 years old, gets up probably at the crack of dawn, some cases 5:30 in the morning, often before the sun, and they head into the urban communities around the country, and they go into some of the highest need schools, and as a team, they stand outside of the schoolhouse steps, and they clap and cheer for every student as they walk into the building, giving them high fives. And then they go into the school, and they serve all day as tutors, mentors, and role models, helping kids who are probably, many of them, destined not to graduate, to graduate, by helping them get back on track.
Now, I've read somewhere that there are about 13,500 high schools in the United States, and 12% of them yield 50% of the dropouts. Is CityYear focusing on those specific high schools in that 12%?
Exactly. Yes, this is a breakthrough study that Johns Hopkins University put together, and it did find that about 1 million students drop out in America. The study further found that you can identify who's likely to drop out by these early warning indicators, high absences, poor behaviors, or getting an F in math or English. So what we do is we go into the high schools that have the worst dropout records, as well as the elementary and middle schools that feed into them. Mm. So we're in these students' lives in a multi-year continuum of care from grades 3 through 9.
Can you provide a concrete example or two of the experience of one of the children being impacted?
Yeah, so this is a student who even the teachers had said, no one's been able to get through to this student. She's incredibly disruptive. It turns out that the core member found out that this student's mother was being deported. Now, if you can imagine trying to come to school every single day and being said, these are your lessons, these are the things you're supposed to do, this is the way you're supposed to deport yourself, all these other things. But no one had yet learned what was really happening in her life. Their mother's being deported. And she had put up all these walls around her. Mm-hmm. But the core member has that time mm-hmm. and that capability to be there. And as the student pushes her away, she just keeps saying, I'm still here for you. Mm-hmm. And eventually what happens time and again is the student realizes, you're not going to go away. You really are here for me. And she opened up to that student. and that student succeeded and blossomed.
City Year now looks a lot different from the City Year that you started in 1988. Can you describe what your initial intention was?
So initially, we decided we really wanted to show that national service could really help all nonprofit initiative. Whatever it is that you were doing in your nonprofit, you could do more of it if you had dedicated young people to help and join you. Mm-hmm. So we basically offered these idealistic young people to all the nonprofits in the community.
Ranging from
building community gardens, say in the morning, to helping senior citizens in the afternoon, to running after-school programs. Really the full range of nonprofit initiatives, the food banks. And then the exciting thing is that AmeriCorps got started, and there were many organizations that were now developing. We certainly no longer needed to be doing all different kinds of work. And we found that our unique asset of these idealistic young people could have its highest use if we put them into the highest need schools.
You have a powerful partnership network at City Year, ranging from Timberland to IBM and JetBlue. Timberland, for example, supplied all the boots for your initial core members and now continue to supply the shoes. It just seems like you've had a charmed life a little bit since inception with these partnerships. Is that the case?
So when we started City Year, we sat down on this new computer. It was called a Macintosh computer. We fancied ourselves as social entrepreneurs, and we were inspired by, at the time, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak were starting a computer business out of their garage. And we said, what if we sat at my parents' dining room table in Belmont, Massachusetts, and hammered out this idea? And we had this document that said, please support this program called City Year. Would you give us our first grant? And we went around. We get meetings with companies and philanthropic leaders. And the interesting thing is, in the beginning, almost nobody said no, but nobody said yes. They would all ask, who's already supporting you? And so what we ended up doing, we sent out applications to say, be part of our pilot program for City Year, frankly, even before we had all the money. So what we ended up doing is we got these wonderful applications, and we asked questions on what are the three biggest problems facing society? Why do you want to serve? We were offering at the time $60 a week. So what we ended up doing is we photocopied the applications. We brought them into meetings. And after we talked about what we were doing, we said, will you just spend a couple minutes reading these? Mm-hmm. And literally, the idealism of the young people would jump off the page. And I'm convinced that's why we got our first resources. The very first company to do that was then called Bank of Boston. Now it's Bank of America. Bain & Company, the consulting firm, was also there on day one. We have Comcast, CSX, the freight train company, Microsoft, Cisco.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Michael Brown, co-founder of City Year, an organization focused on improving the graduation rate in struggling public schools. City Year provides targeted intervention by focusing on improving attendance, tutoring, mentoring, and running after school programs. I want to talk about your personal history. You have had a commitment to service seemingly since very early on. Even in college, you took a year off and worked for Representative Leon Panetta, the Democrat from California. How did that happen?
Well, the very first day I got to college, I went to Harvard University, and the president of the university was then Derek Bok. He welcomed all the freshmen together in the same room, and he said, I want to welcome you to Harvard and ask you to please go away. That was his opening line. And what he meant by that was, you don't have to just go through 4 years. You can go and do something different, come back with a different perspective, perhaps with a passion. And I did that. I spent a year working on Capitol Hill after my sophomore year for then Representative Leon Panetta. And Leon had legislation about an idea I had never heard of called voluntary national service. So he introduced me to this concept. And his legislation would have created a commission to go around the country and study the idea and come back to Congress with legislation for perhaps a big program one day.
What did your parents do?
My father was a real estate attorney in Boston for 50 years. My mom was at home raising us.
You're one of five?
I'm one of five. I often say that I got my values from my parents. It was a Jewish home. My father used to love Bible stories, and we used to talk about things. I mean, one of the times I remember, he said, "It says in the Talmud that if you're walking through the desert and there's two people and there's only enough water for one, and that one person has it, is there an obligation to share it?" And I'm like, "Dad, I'm only 5 years old." But we used to have conversations like that. I realize, and it matters what you talk to your children about. And my mom kept a home of Jewish ritual. And so somewhere between the rituals and these other kinds of things, I think that had a big impact on me. At the same time, mm-hmm. I grew up at a time when we were racing for the moon. There was always something happening, something big. And then when you add the 1960s to it, and all of the idealism of the 60s, I think when you combine all that, by the time I had heard about this idea of national service, it sort of was the institutionalization of the idealism that I felt inside of me, that I felt could be brought out of every young person if we simply called on them institutionally to give a year of service.
Your co-founder, Alan Casey, whom you went to college with and you were roommates with, starting freshman year, what was his inclination towards service? He worked for Gary Hart during the presidential campaign in 1984.
So Alan Casey and I were literally assigned to be roommates together first day of freshman year at Harvard. And Sidia, really, we can thank the Harvard freshman dean's office, which was responsible for putting roommates together. Mm-hmm. And anyone that knew Alan in high school before I even met him, and anyone that's met him since, knows that he's an extraordinarily idealistic person. And so I was immediately attracted to that idealism. And we started conversations freshman year, like a lot of people have in their dorm room. And as we began to talk about it, we talked about this idea of national service.
You had a meeting with President Clinton, who at the time was a candidate for president in 1992. And you gave him the seed of the idea for AmeriCorps. Can you describe that encounter? How did it happen?
So it was it was December of 1991 during the presidential selection process of 92. It was just a couple months before the New Hampshire primary. So Governor Bill Clinton and other Democratic candidates were hanging around New Hampshire and Massachusetts. And we got a call and said, he's been asked about national service. You have this program. Can he come and visit you? So he came and he spent the better part of a couple hours. At the end of that conversation, one of the young people in our program literally took the sweatshirt off his back that said Sidier on it and gave it to him and said, Governor, please don't forget us. And that was in December of 1991. Now, fast forward to November of 1992, 11 months later, we certainly hadn't seen Bill Clinton. But in the meantime, he'd been elected president of the United States, and he was now president-elect. And it was the day after Thanksgiving, so he's 3 weeks into being president-elect. CNN is covering his every move. He's out there jogging. And guess what? He's jogging in the Sidier sweatshirt that Stephen, our core member, had given to him 11 months before. Well, I'm at home, and I'm reaching for the phone to call Alan Casey, my partner in all this. The phone's ringing. Well, I'm reaching for it, and I know it's Alan. I say, you watching this? Mm-hmm. He said, yeah, yeah. We all said, this changes everything. Because President Clinton stopped, and he was asked, President-elect Clinton, what will be your priorities as president? And he said, the national debt, health care, the economy. Still sound familiar. And he said, and national service will be my fourth priority. And he's wearing the Sidier sweatshirt. Mm. And we realized that he was very serious about starting this. And we worked with his administration on this AmeriCorps concept. And we realized that the power of the presidency to put these ideas forward is incredible. Today, AmeriCorps is the federal investment in national service. It funds many programs. And we're one of those programs that is sponsored by it. We're very grateful to Bill Clinton for getting it started and for supporting us all these years.
In 2003, you helped to form the Save AmeriCorps Coalition, where you spent more than 100 hours testifying in front of Congress because they were about to cut funding of AmeriCorps in half. Can you talk about that experience?
Sure. So it was almost a perfect storm of things. One thing that had happened after September 11th is so many people wanted to do AmeriCorps that there were so many grants out there and people serving that they had to actually pull the grants back from the next year. So we don't have enough. So what we did is we got together with other organizations that had utilized AmeriCorps funds, and we all came together and we formed the Save AmeriCorps Coalition. And within about 100 days, we had 44 governors that had signed a letter for emergency funding, 83 senators, and we held essentially a round-the-clock citizens hearing on Capitol Hill. They gave us rooms, and we had people come in from all the country, and it was literally for 100 hours. It was four straight days, including at 2 and 3 in the morning, young people who had served, organizations that had benefited, parents of these young people. They testified. I think it made a huge difference. We got a lot of the funding back that year, And the next year, we got the highest funding ever.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Michael Brown, co-founder of City Year, an organization focused on improving the graduation rate in struggling public schools. You have affiliates in Johannesburg and London. How did that come to be?
So the one in Johannesburg, we had an opportunity to meet with President Clinton right after he left office. And we said to him that we wanted to start an international fellowship in his name called the Clinton Democracy Fellowship to invite people from all over the world to see what U.S. programs were doing and to learn from what service programs are happening around the world. It would go in both directions. And we were going to go try to raise money for it and get it started. And he said, great, let's go do that together. And then 2 months later, we got a phone call. He had called the chair of our board, Eli Siegel at the time, who had worked with him to build AmeriCorps. And he said, I just got a call from Nelson Mandela. He wants me to speak in South Africa about how to build civil society. And he said, I want to bring those Cityer folks and show them about Cityer and AmeriCorps, about how they could engage young people in service. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, from that one meeting, within 2 months, we were on an airplane with Bill Clinton, and we went to South Africa for an extraordinary experience with him and Nelson Mandela. And we were there to share our experience and to learn from theirs. But from that, people in South Africa said, would you start a Cityer program? And if you could have told me back when we were all struggling with apartheid, back when I was in college and all, it was our number one issue, that we'd be able to work in a free just South Africa with Nelson Mandela having gone from prisoner to president. Mm-hmm. Of course we were going to say yes to all of that, even though it was 10,000 miles away. If you don't talk to them by 10 in the morning, it's too late. But it was a labor of love to build City or South Africa.
Going back to the beginning, I've read somewhere when you were starting City Year, you said it was a little bit like running off to join the circus. Why did you say that?
Well, here I had gone to these amazing institutions, and I loved the law, and I easily could have gone down that path. I was on the law review. I really thought I could see that path, but I had this sort of other pull. And yet everybody would understand, it's easy to sort of explain to your grandmother that you'd go from Harvard Law School into a top firm, and I had these wonderful offers as well. So the idea of saying no to all that, and I'm going to go just no job, no money, and just simply bang away at this new Macintosh computer and try to fund this national service program, no one really talked then about social entrepreneurship. So it was a little bit of explaining to people that there was even a career path in going off and doing something like that.
But luckily you had a safety net under the tightrope walking life that you were about to pursue, because you could always go back to clerk for Judge Breyer.
So. No, exactly. It was just that I was doing something that just seemed so different from all of that experience.
What do you remember most distinctly about working with Justice Stephen Breyer?
I had an extraordinary experience working with Justice Breyer. He's brilliant. You know, most judges I found at the time, you know, their clerks would sort of help to write the opinions. And, you know, we would do that. We would give him our drafts of things, and then he would say, thank you very much. And he would take the citations, but he would rewrite everything because he could cut through anything. And he would love to come back and talk to us as clerks about these ideas of the law. When I said I wanted to start Cityer, he was incredibly supportive. And he's come out to do everything I've ever asked of him. And my favorite one was when he came and he swore in our core, because we have a pledge that we take. And he said beautifully, he said, my job is to write about the Constitution. He said to these young people, but you're living it and making it come alive. Mm-hmm. And it speaks volumes about what kind of person he is.
You live in Boston, and your wife is a pediatrician. She treats HIV patients.
That's right.
And you have three children. Do you teach them the Talmud, and do you raise them in a Jewish home?
We're a mixed religious family, mm-hmm. And we raise them both with Jewish and Catholic values. As you mentioned, my wife is a pediatrician, and she's my hero. She treats children with AIDS. She's kept children alive into their adulthood.
What's her name?
Charlotte, Dr. Charlotte Mao.
How did you meet Charlotte?
We met at college. We were both at Courier House at Harvard College, and we spent a summer tutoring for the Harvard Summer School and fell in love.
Were you married when you started City Year?
I got married in 1991, so 3 years into City Year. And she's my rock. And at home, we have a saying, Mom's always right, and she is. She has the most extraordinary judgment and character, and in that sense, she's been an incredible backbone for City Year.
Do you ever have anything negative to say?
Oh, I don't know. I suppose I can get frustrated like anybody else, but I do. I'm surrounded every day in what I would call a culture of idealism, which is not naivete. And at City Year, we talk about snuffing out cynicism because it's just the enemy of positive good. So I take idealism seriously and as an art and a practice.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Jessica. It's my pleasure.
My guest has been Michael Brown, co-founder of City Year. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.